This is Circe Olson-Westner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeros, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, Together We Serve. I'm speaking with Michelle Green and her mother, Willie Pearl Young, and her sister, Adrienne Young Battle. Hey, ladies.
Hi.
So we're doing a phone interview today because you guys are all on the East Coast and I'm in New Mexico. Hopefully we'll have a good reception and a great discussion. So I just like to, you know, say thanks a lot for joining us. And I'd like to start with Mrs. Young, Willie Pearl, and just mention that you're the wife of a Tuskegee Airman. And I wanted to know, was that when it was the Army Air Corps or the Army or the Air Force? Are you an Air Force family?
Air Force.
It started as the Army Air Corps. It wasn't desegregated until after the war.
Ah, okay. All right, because I know I had seen Army Air Corps, but I wasn't sure. So I just would like Mrs. Young, to tell a little bit about your husband to our listeners.
You want me to talk about the base?
Yeah.
Oh, we're down there.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, we were stationed at Tuskegee, and we lived in a little house off the base, and I used to go walking during the day, and my husband was in a P-51, and while I was walking, I would look up at the sky because he would do little stunts and things, and he was trying to show off or tell me what he was doing. And I walked with my head up looking at the sky most of the time. And so based on that, we were stationed there, and we love being there. Only thing I can't say is that I thought we would have more room, which we didn't have.
Oh.
So she said that he used to buzz the clothesline.
Oh my gosh. I'm sure he was popular with all the neighbors.
Well, they come to see him do it because he was just outstanding doing things like that.
So I wanted to know, why did he decide to serve in the military, and why become a pilot?
Well, at that particular time, was almost at the end of the war, and they needed pilots.
Mm.
And at that time, he was carrying three wings, like navigator and a bombardier, and so when he finished those two schools, they needed more pilots, so they had to train him for the third session. So based on this, that's why he was a pilot, and he got to be an instructor pilot, and then he got fighter pilot, and he was triple rated.
Wow.
So with him being triple rated, he was having three sets of wings and everything, and it just so happened that this is what happened to him.
He also flew in Korea and served in Vietnam, a special operations group.
Wow. Yeah, that's, we'll talk a little bit more about that later, but there's not a whole lot of people that can say that they were in all three conflicts. Getting back to, so you were married when he went into the military, Mrs. Young, or did you, how did you guys meet?
Oh, we met when he was in high school, and we went around together for quite a bit, and I had brothers, and he used to come up see them in the meantime. We little do a little calling in between. Oh gosh. In Kentucky, we had every day around 4 o'clock, we'd look up at the sky, and we had a mail airplane. It comes over the mountain, And all the people would get out in the road, and they would look at this airplane. And one day I was looking at the airplane, not realizing that one day I would be working on that plane, or it would come over, and, you know, we just didn't know what was going on, but I can't believe that I was working on that plane, and my husband was working on the plane, and we all look up at the sky, and we see this plane every day. So then it got to be a habit where we began to look for the plane.
Mm.
And now, ended up with the war, I was in a riveter and worked on this plane, that type of plane. And the reason I was on that particular plane, I was a riveter, and here my husband got a chance to fly the plane, so it made it real neat for us thinking about all these things and being able to do some of these things. And that's why I think him being a pilot, it just something that stuck with us.
Mm. Well, so let's talk about you then. I was going to ask another question, but we'll go back to that one. So you said that you were a riveter, and I think people of my generation think Rosie the Riveter. What is a riveter, and what did you do?
well, we worked on this plane, and we had a driller, and then we had one part, it was a drill, and then the other was on the buffer. And we worked on the gas tank of this big plane.
Mm.
And they only had a certain type of people to work on this plane because we had to be a certain height and all of this. And so we had to rivet this plane in certain areas. And that's how we got to be a riveter.
So
we had a riveter, and then we had a buffer on the other side.
So was it like an assembly line, or?
It was assembly line, and that's what we did.
Wow.
You know, they were actually inside the turret. Women, they could only be 5'1 or shorter,
wow.
Or 5'2. And they actually would have to crawl inside this turret and rivet from the inside. So what you need to ask Mom is how she and her girlfriend would go out and party the night before and take turns napping in these turrets.
No.
They would take turns napping, and when the supervisor came around, then a girl on the outside would rivet to wake up the person inside. That's what she needs to be telling you the truth.
Yeah. I don't think we'll disillusion our listeners on that.
I left off the best part of it.
No doubt. Well, that's very cool. Well, you know, the war effort. So, but getting back to the question I was going to ask before the riveter segue, when we think of the Tuskegee Airmen, you know, we in this country hold them in such esteem and awe. And you know, it's legendary. And so when people mention the Tuskegee Airmen, it's like a, kind of like a hero. Well, it is a hero. But what I was going to ask is, when you are living the life, do you feel you guys are part of something legendary, or was it just a job?
Well, can I speak to that?
Sure.
Okay, so for us, it was our life. Dad was very humble. He was never one to boast, brag, or put himself in the limelight. So for us, that was our life. As Mom said, he used to fly over the clothesline. She used to see him fly daily. That's the life that we lived.
Mm-hmm.
I did not honestly realize the historical significance until I was able to escort my father to Obama's inauguration. He invited the Tuskegee Airmen to take part in his inauguration. So it wasn't until I was on a bus that was escorted into Washington, D.C. with police escorts, and I saw thousands of people lining the streets, cheering and waving,
because the bus clearly was noted Tuskegee Airmen, and it was loaded with all of these gentlemen in the late 80s, 90 years old, and as they got off of the bus, there were two military members from each branch of the service that escorted them four rows from the front. As I looked back at the sea of people behind us, that's when I got it.
Wow. I mean, that was, you know, that was decades after. It's amazing how we just take our dads for granted as being dad, you know? Wow.
They call the Tuskegee Airmen 100 percenters. They drew the best educated college people and some people that had flown crop dusters, and they recruited them, and they had to take admissions tests. Mm. And so, of course, there was the segregation that they had to face. At that time, their flight instructors were white, and they had to prove themselves.
Mm.
So they would take these tests. They knew the pressure was on them. The eyes of the country was on them. And so when they aced the course, they called themselves the 100 percenters. The instructor would say, "How did you do?" And they would say, "100 percent, sir." And that was, and when we asked Dad about it, he said, "We just had a job to do, and we didn't really think about it at the time."
I had another gentleman I was interviewing, and he said, because, you know, he felt like there was always a harder bias against his family, and they all had to strive to do so much better just to overcome that, you know, prejudice, that bias. So I want to start with Mrs. Young again, and then ask you brats the same thing. But where all were you stationed in your husband's career? So World War II to Vietnam, so what, 30 years?
Oh, we had a lot of bases in between.
Yeah, so where all were you stationed?
We were in, Tuskegee was the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, we went to Biloxi.
Mm-hmm.
From Biloxi, we went to Germany. Came back from Germany, we had Ramstein, Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were stationed at, Keesler. I don't know if I mentioned that. Keesler Air Force Base,
mm-hmm.
Brunswick, Maine. In Brunswick, Maine, that was our last stop. No, San Antonio twice. San Antonio, Texas twice.
Well, it sounds like
we got to see the world at that time.
I was going to say,
every chance we got, we were on a bus, or Dad was taking us different places.
Mm-hmm.
All the museums we had to see, and he was real strict about our learning and stuff. We just didn't sit around. We did things. We learned so many things while we were in the military. We learned how to ski and bowl and golf and all these things.
Wow.
And also, my husband would take the little guys shopping. I mean, going to the little guys to the museum and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But my other daughter, we love to shop. So it was just a big fun trip for us as far as being different military. And I never got bored, because all these bases, there was something missing. And one of the things is I read a lot, seen a lot, and all the time we were at different bases, it didn't bother me because I was busy doing other things.
So what was your favorite and least favorite assignment?
My favorite assignment?
Yeah.
My husband's assignment?
Where was your favorite place to live?
Oh, my favorite place to live, I think in Maine. We had ski slopes 15 minutes away, and we did a lot of skiing up there. We had cross-country skis and all that. And, of course, we invested on different types of things we would do every year. But I think, in my case, I would love being in Maine, because the weather was different.
Mm.
It was not all hot all the time. We had our seasons. And based on that, it
turned out to be a nice trip.
Mm-hmm. What was your least favorite? Did you have a least favorite?
My least favorite, I guess, Biloxi, I guess. That's down at Keesler.
So Michelle and Adrian, what about your favorites and your least favorite places to live?
This is Michelle. My favorite was Ramstein, Germany. I was there from the first to the fifth grade, and that's when I found out that I was going to be a writer. Mm-hmm. My fifth grade teacher, Mrs. Rao, put a note on my report card that I was going to be a writer, and she's true. That's what I do. That's what I love. And we got to travel all over just about every country in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
My least favorite was Biloxi. We were there in 1965,
mm-hmm.
At the height of the Civil War, civil rights movement, and the prejudice was just outstanding. In fact, Adrian and I went to a Catholic school, and the base commander told the nuns that if a hair on our head was bothered, the wrath of the entire Air Force would come down upon us. Upon them, and so we got to collect the milk money. We were the only two black students in the school.
So the schools had been desegregated by then, but there was still a lot of hostility. Were the kids mean, or?
Well, tell me about our older sister.
Well, the older sister, she was going to school. She was out of high school, but she was going to school, and she thought that she, more than we did, experienced prejudice. But in her case, she got to the school, nobody said a word to her at all. And she thought, you know, every day she felt this, and it wasn't until maybe weeks later that one girl approached her and they found out, oh, she's nice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what she didn't know is that the base commander had also contacted the local high school and let them know that if anyone so much as looked at us the wrong way, he would blow them off the face of the map because he had the air power to do so. And but as far as Michelle and myself, yes, we went to this Catholic school, and we never knew any different, and mm-hmm. that was because, you know, not only were they warned, but they were Christians, and mm. they treated us as well
mm.
or as poorly as the next one that got out of line and needed a whack with the ruler, but they were not.
Well, we went to these different schools. That was 2 years
mm.
before they had segregated schools.
Mm.
We was in during this time, we had already been to the Catholic school and other places,
mm.
and that we shared a lot of things that other people didn't share, because my husband, he was an officer, and it left the door open where we could do a lot of things that mm. other people couldn't do.
Mm, mm,
as mm. you know, the military has really high standards,
mm.
and so when we would travel from base to base, we were usually ahead of the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my first day in Maine at the Catholic school, they had a spelling bee,
mm-hmm.
and I won. Everybody was like, she just came in, how is this possible? So we were always catching up with whatever school system we were in,
mm-hmm.
and you know, that's the thing about Air Force military brats, that they love to learn, they love to travel, they assimilate very, very well,
mm-hmm.
and that's part of our legacy.
Well, my son also went to Catholic school. He was the only non-Catholic in his class, and I credit...
Yes, and we weren't Catholic.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but I credit his education, his Catholic education, for teaching him grammar, and, I mean, it was... He got a good education, so... back to on-base living, then, for Mrs. Young. Were you active with the wives' clubs, or did you work, or did you have to volunteer, or were you told what you had to do?
I was there almost every time we went on a trip and everything. We went on different trips and everything, and it made it nice because I bowled on a bowling team, and I just did everything I could do,
mm-hmm.
and I liked being late because I would go out and buy something really nice, and I always about 5 minutes late for the luncheon and stuff,
yeah.
and I always like to go off and take off my coat because it had a red lining in it. But I used to do these things, but I really enjoyed being in the position.
Mm-mm.
And as far as my daughter is concerned, she was there most of the time. And when she went to the school in Biloxi, the teacher that was giving her a hard time and everything, she turned out to be a nice lady because she came to my daughter and she said to her, "I never had straight A's on my car before." So it wasn't that it was segregated or anything like that. It's just one of the things that she gave her just report. And that's how we lived.
When you were... When you were doing all these wives activities, I understand that you like to make an entrance. That's why you were late, so you could show your coat off. Were the wives groups segregated, or was it all the officers' wives? And
No, I didn't see that at all.
Okay.
We we went on trips and we did everything, and there was no segregated nothing. I was just one of them. I was no special person or nothing like that. It's just that when I got ready to enroll my girls to school, one of the wife club ladies told me that she had been down to this school before and that it was a nice school, and she was trying to help me get into the school. So we went down on a Sunday to this school, and we found out they had a meeting. And when they had this meeting, one of the girls had told me about it and everything, and I enrolled the girls on a Sunday. Of course, I was a little depressed when we didn't get a call the next day. And one of the ladies that in the group, she told me that she had to do the same thing. It was not anything about me being colored or anything like that, but it's just that she had to go through the same, through what I had. And that made it different. We never had any trouble with segregated in the wives club.
Okay.
One of the things I need to kind of chime in here is back then, and we're talking in the early, 50s, early 60s, there was a hierarchy, so they had... It was not black and white. It was officers and enlisted.
That's right.
If you were an officer, you were expected to act as an officer. You did not socialize with the enlisted. So that was a system. Hopefully it's not like that now, but in the past, that's how it was. The difference was that in our household, my dad socialized with his troops. He didn't care about hierarchy. They respected him as not only just an officer, but a wonderful man that they genuinely cared about. And we remember times as children that he would get phone calls on a Friday night, and they called them come-as-you-are parties. So his troops would take turns calling. Come-as-you-are, they were to drop everything, head over there and party. So he'd hang up. 5 minutes later, he'd get another call. So by the time he got the fifth call, he and Mom were out the door again, and the oldest sister had to babysit the two little ones because my dad was hanging out with his troops.
Yeah.
That's how he was. And with us, we didn't care because I knew every time he came back, there was a Slim Jim in it for me. He would always make sure to bring me back a Slim Jim, or they would bring something from that party for us to snack on.
That's cool. So I wanted to ask this both from the perspective of military wife, but then also for you girls about being military kids. So first of all, what was the best thing about being a military wife, and what was the worst thing? And then Adrian and Michelle, what was the best and worst about being a brat?
What was the best thing, Mom?
I didn't get the question of being a military wife.
Oh, the best thing, I got a chance to travel a lot and do a lot of things that I didn't do. And I liked that part of it. And I didn't have any flax on trying to be something that I wasn't. I was just
a friendly person and had got along with most of the girls. I didn't have any trouble with that.
And then what was the worst thing about being a military wife?
The worst thing? The worst thing, I had military wife. We were stationed down at Keesler, and we didn't have housing for us on the base. And so I found out that the place we had to go to for temporary quarters, it was down in the enlisted section. And we went out to, down at this section, we had to get a stay at this place until we found quarters in the officers' quarters. And this one lady, she was the sergeant's wife, and she ruled the roost. She didn't draw back anything. And so at that husband, I mean, at that time, my husband was second officer. He was a second class, and she ruled the roost. She would tell us when we had to do everything.
Wow.
And when I moved in there, I outranked all the things that was there, and though we didn't have to wash and iron whenever she told us to do, because that was the worst experience I ever had, because we didn't do a lot of things we should have done because we lived in the enlisted quarters.
So she told the women who were living there what day was wash day? Holy cow.
Yes. She said, she came out one day and I came down the hall with my clothes going to the basement. So she came out in the hall. She said, "Mrs. Young, this is not your day."
Okay.
And I couldn't get over that because it's a nice sunny day, and the lines were out there, and nobody was using them, and I didn't see, why do I have to wait tomorrow, and I'm here now? So right away, my clothes went into the wash, and I hung them outside. They got dry and all that. We didn't have dryers then.
Yeah.
But I couldn't be told when and where I had to wash.
And then what happened the next day after this happened? She looks out, and everybody was washing on whatever day they wanted. So she was a pioneer even back then.
Yes, the laundry, the laundry wars. So Adrian, what was the worst thing? What was the best thing about being a brat for you, and also the worst?
The best for me was being in Germany, because we got a chance to literally see the world. And what it special for me being in Germany was the Steiff Bears. About every payday, Dad would go into the little German shop, and he would buy track for my little German train set. I was the tomboy of the group and was always underfoot. So we just had so many fabulous memories and experiences from being overseas. And the not to mention, when we came back, we traveled aboard the SS United States, which is the government paid for it, but that was at the time the fastest ocean liner in the world. So that in itself was really cool. The worst experience for me was actually when we went back to Lackland for the last time before he retired in 1970. It was difficult because I had to go to a junior high school, and it was really it was hard because it wasn't a base school, and there was a lot of just mean people there.
Yeah, I've heard that there's the rivalry between the town kids and the base kids and things like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was horrible. So, you know, that was only 6 months or so ended, and then he retired there, and we moved to this area.
Yeah.
So
losing our ID cards.
Yeah, no, a lot of kids say that. So Michelle, you mentioned to me that you had some experiences while you were in Maryland.
Yes, this is Michelle. Well, the best part for me was, again, the travel and seeing all the highlights of Europe. When my mother was young, she dreamed of fairy tale castles, and we saw castles. We saw Rome, we saw Spain, we traveled all around. It was just a dream. I took my first ballet lessons there with a ballet master, which I continued all the way through high school. But the worst part was being out of step with our black culture, because the places that we were, I mean, black history just wasn't taught. But when we spent 5 years in Maine, while others, people our age, were listening to Motown and learning about black history, we were out of step with the dress, the culture, the language, and everything. So when we moved to Maryland, I went to three different high schools. I should have gone to a fourth high school. So when I came to Suitland, Maryland, they were in the throes of the Black Power movement, and everyone was wearing afros, everybody was doing all this stuff, and I was still wearing knee socks and plaid skirts. I couldn't dance. My hair wouldn't go into afro. I used to clip on fake afro puffs. It didn't work. My language, you know, I spoke German. I was learning to speak French. I was in the honors program, and so I had social isolation because many of my friends were Caucasian, and you know, when I hung out with the honors club, the French club was a national merit scholar, so that kind of set me apart from my classmates. And so the pressure that I felt, I guess you could call it almost reverse racism. I just felt completely out of step, and all of my dates were arranged. My two prom dates were arranged because I said Dad wouldn't let us have boyfriends.
Well, I think there are a lot of teenage girls that think their dads are over the top about that kind of thing.
With three daughters, you better believe it.
Yeah. So, I wanted to, you know, segue into something a lot more sad. And I know that your dad and your husband was wonderful. He sounds like an awesome person that, you know, anybody would want to get to know. And it must have been really hard when he passed on. And I didn't know if you wanted to talk a little bit about that.
Oh, absolutely, because it was phenomenal. He left this world the way he lived it while he was here. And it was awesome.
Tell me about the circle in the bedroom.
So one of the things, towards the end, he had dementia. And for him, that was not forgetting who we were. It was simply the body forgetting to tell, you know, telling him how to swallow. So he had issues there. But he was at the hospital. And once they found out that this was a Tuskegee Airman and his military career, there would be lines of veterans and doctors and nurses coming by to talk to him. And even at the time where he was, as they say, non-responsive, they would still talk to him as if he heard every word. And one of the things that happened during that time, he was not responding to physical therapy, but they made sure they would come in and they would move his legs and move his arms, just to make sure that he was supple. And this one particular time, he had the most awesome corpsman who knew about Dad's being a pilot. And as it turned out, his father was a pilot. He flew commercial planes or smaller planes. So he was with his aide, and he said, "You know what?" He said, "Let me try something." So he took my dad's hand and he put it in a fist, and he stuck, you know, he put his hand in a fist and stuck his thumb up. He took my dad's hand and put it around his hand. He said, Major Young, need to check your rudder, sir, check your rudder. And would you believe my dad, this is my non-responsive, can't hear you, doesn't know who he is dad, takes his hand and he pulled it to the right and he pulled that plane lever like he was flying it.
Wow.
And he started pedaling his feet. And then the corpsman said, the other one said, "Cool." Okay. So then he said, Major Young, need to bank right, left, sir." So Dad slowly took his hand and he moved to the left. So then he went to his feet, put his hands up, he said, "Check your rudder, sir," pushed it, and Dad slowly pushed it like he was flying that plane. Wow. And that's something that it's you can't believe something like actually happened.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it impressed the family so very much that at Dad's funeral, by request of the family, we had the corpsman come to the service, and we let everybody know what he had done and how much he meant to our family. Mm-hmm. And at the funeral, I had set up a display. I had all Dad's, you know, his Tuskegee, he had his flight suit, all his memorabilia, everything.
Yeah.
When that corpsman walked in the door, I swear to God, I saw an aura. Like, you could tell this is who it was because it just he just had this presence. So that was really awesome.
Wow.
And then when Dad, he went from being, oh, you're taking him home, to end of life. And we're like, what? What is this? You know, he took a turn that we didn't even know.
Mm-hmm.
So we brought him home, and he was actually here for just 2 days before he passed.
Mm-hmm.
But as he was in his hospital room in the bed, in a back room, everybody was around him. We were laughing. We were joking. We were talking about old times. If you weren't in this house, you wouldn't believe that this was like, you know, near-death experiences. Oh, my God. We lived our life laughing, joking all the time. So we did this, and then we're all, you know, the niece was on the phone with hospice and telling us, okay, this is what to expect. Now his respiration and walking us through the end-of-life process. So we were to look at the clock, you know, time of death, because yes, we all knew it was going to happen. So just before he passed, all at once, you know, Mom standing at his head, you know, the head of the bed, he opened his eyes, he reached up, he grabbed my mom, pulled her down, gave her two quick pecks on the lips, laid back, closed his eyes. That was it. We looked at the clock. Everybody was silent. All I could say was, really, Dad? Do you know, he died at 12 o'clock midnight. Not a minute before, not a minute after.
Wow.
And for those who are non-pilots, midnight or 12 o'clock was 12 o'clock high, because when they leave the earth and go, they go straight up at 12 o'clock.
Right.
So for us and anybody that was a pilot or has ever flown a jet, they know the significance of midnight.
Wow.
And for us, with Dad, 12 o'clock is when he chose to leave us. He used to carry the poem High Flight in his wallet, as most pilots do, and on his gravestone at Arlington it says High Flight. That came from a poem of a 19-year-old British pilot in World War II that made the poem while he was in the air because he thought he would never see his parents again. And sure enough, it was a letter to his parents, and sure enough, right after that, he crashed.
Wow.
And it's a beautiful poem that all Air Force people know. Dad has a plaque inscribed on it, with the poem inscribed on it.
And it says, I think that one of the last lines is something like, and touch the face of God.
Yes, and touch the face of God. It used to be the sign-off on television when television would end, and there are several different versions of the song. They're just beautiful.
Yeah, well, that whole story gave me goosebumps, and then to end with High Flight, absolutely, because there's so much you could read into that, you know? I mean, choosing to die at midnight, going up, touching the face of God, very... Well, it just I do have goosebumps. So you
then
said
we could get back to the whole funeral, and this is something that this is crazy. But because our family's crazy, I can tell you this and share this with you. So because he was a veteran, yes, and because he was highly decorated, Vietnam, MacSog, the whole nine. We had to make arrangements for him to be buried at Arlington. That was the one thing that he insisted on. He wanted to be buried at Arlington so that when Mom and I went to the BX at Belvoir, we can just wave at him. That was his reason. But with the funeral director, as many people may or may not know, that to get in Arlington, you have to meet certain criteria, and there's a wait list. You could wait a year before a burial. So we went to have him interred, and the only date that they had was October 31st, which
Halloween.
Is Halloween. Now, in this family, Halloween is a big deal. We decorate, we have, I always made food. It was a big deal for us.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as my dad, because he was a pilot, the heart rate has to be very slow. So Dad, naturally, his heart rate was always slow because he practiced controlled breathing.
Mm-hmm.
When he was even younger, he would lay on the sofa like he was asleep. We would think the man was gone because you couldn't see his chest rise, and we would joke around. Sometimes we'd take a lily and put it on his chest. His arms were crossed. He looked like he was dead, so we'd put the lily on there, and other times we would put our fingers under there to make sure we felt air. And
poor
also,
Dad.
He's very fair. I mean, he had less color than your average Caucasian person. So we used to always make fun of him as being a ghost, or as we called it, a haint.
So, he said his legs looked like fish bellies.
Yeah, his legs looked like fish bellies. So this is a color thing. We had a caste system going on in our own family because Mom's a beautiful, chocolatey brown, and here's pasty Dad. So when the funeral director said that he had the 31st, he couldn't understand how excited we got. Oh, that's perfect. So he was actually interred with full honors on Halloween.
Wow. Poor funeral director.
So the funeral, this is something else that's significant. So Dad was never, ever late in his life, his entire life. Mom, as she already told you, it's on record, she was never on time for anything. And Dad used to always say, Pearl, he said, you're going to be late for your own funeral. So here's the day of the funeral. Everybody's there. The display is up, and everybody's waiting. And
no Dad.
No Dad. So I had to get on the phone. It's 45 minutes, and my dad's late for his funeral. He wasn't up there. So we called the funeral director, and unfortunately, for once in their life, for a high-level, highly visible funeral, they got their times mixed up. Dad was down the street. So,
like two blocks away.
When they got him there, the funeral director was... He just saw lawsuit. You could see lawsuit all over his face.
Well, he's mortified.
So when our oldest sister got up there, all eyes were on her, and she said ever so calmly, she said, my dad was never late for anything in his life. The funeral director looked at his assistant, and you could see his face ashen. She said, this is the first time that Dad was late and my mother was on time. And the whole audience, if that's what you call mourners, were laughing hysterically. The funeral director looked at the other one and gave the nervous... He didn't know whether to laugh or cry, but after that, everything was fine, and he was buried with the most beautiful honors, including the caisson.
Yes, it was a beautiful day at Arlington with the caisson. It was amazing. And Adrian, let me tell you about a little tradition we have in our family that Dad started with his first grandchild.
Someone's
birthday, he would take the kazoo and blow the kazoo happy birthday. And this is a tradition that has carried on ever since. He also had a habit of chewing a half a stick of gum and leaving the other half in his pocket. In fact, we had a dog once. When he took off his shirt, he chewed through the shirt to get to the piece of gum. So I didn't find out. I knew about this, but I just found this little detail out a couple of days ago.
Yesterday. I didn't know.
Yeah, I didn't know this part. But my sister Adrian, she's so irreverent. When he was buried, she put a kazoo between his gloved fingers and a half a stick of gum in his pocket.
She didn't know about the gum.
I didn't know about the gum. I knew about the kazoo. And I looked at him, I thought, oh, that's just not right. And then I said, yeah, it is. And my youngest son, Evan, was flying in from, he went to the Berklee College of Music, and he was flying in, and his dad was bringing him. They had car trouble, so he got there late, and just before they blew taps, we looked up, and Evan and his girlfriend came bounding over the headstones. I mean, they were jumping like they were sprinting.
Oh, my gosh.
Just in time to see him, you know, put in the ground. So, yeah, it was an extraordinary life and an extraordinary death. Well, I'm so grateful because he could have been shot down there somewhere else, and I was lucky that we were able to bury him without all the things that would happen to people.
Yeah.
But I'm so grateful for this.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just reading a book a friend of mine wrote about fighter pilots, and, you know, one out of three were going to never make it, you know, to old age.
Yeah.
So
we... One thing we were blessed to have, and this goes back to the inauguration, when I found out that the Tuskegee Airmen were invited to the inauguration, I called somebody and asked, you know, could my dad come by the officers' club to see some of the airmen because maybe he would recognize them. Mm-hmm. And that's when they said, well, I needed proof of his DTA number and all of this. So I said, Dad, I need to get proof. He says, oh, well, it's in the briefcase in my closet. I go in the closet. Not only does he have that record, he has every record, every original document from when he first went into the Army Air Corps to when he got out in 1945. Mm-hmm. I have every record, flight records, who washed out, who graduated, when they went on leave, and why. I have documents signed by, was it Roosevelt? Teddy Roosevelt, thanking them for their efforts after the war. And right after it ended in 1945, a year later, within a year, they recalled a number of the airmen, and my dad was one of those, because what they found was that the German jets outran our own.
Mm.
So they assembled the cream of the crop, the best of the best across the nation, and had a fighter pursuit squadron. Mm. And they actually did testing, you know, test, and that was when Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier for the first time. Never knew until Dad had already passed away that Dad was in his unit.
Mm-hmm.
Flew with Chuck Yeager. Did we ever know that? No. I found this out like last year. And also, it explains why Dad, a week and a half later, had collapsed lung, which took him out of flight duty, because mm-hmm. if Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier, most certainly Dad was going to try to break it higher.
Oh,
so,
dear.
That's one of the things, you know, the documentation that we have go all the way up to when he retired, and then he was civil service at Dahlgren with Desert Storm. So, yes, quite the legacy.
You might remember my the short story Dog Tags that I submitted,
mm-hmm.
and it references my taking him back to Kentucky for the last time, driving in his Porsche.
Yes.
What I didn't mention was, when I was 16 and we were living in San Antonio, he had a Jaguar XKE convertible.
Mm.
That was the car I learned to drive in, and he taught me how to drive on the flight line. Here I was, 16, scared to death. He said, stop looking at the hood, drive this thing.
Oh my gosh.
So I know that Tom Cruise's Top Gun said, I have the need for speed. Dad had the need for speed.
Yeah, I was going to say, those are some nice cars.
Well, that was the closest they can get to a jet, and that's what I was told.
Yeah. So listen, I know you guys, Michelle especially, are starting to write your dad's story.
Yes.
And so I'm getting the sense that this is going to be a labor of love, and you're going to have a lot of information because he kept all his records. But how are you going to do other research and also determine what is, like, important? I think the book is going to be called The Devil's Bargain.
Right. As a writer, it's been very difficult to get a handle, what you call the way in.
Mm.
I mean, he's got a life that it's incredibly detail to try and encompass everything. Mm. So what I have learned is to go to the most compelling part. And for me, the most compelling part was when he went to Vietnam. I was a teenager, caught up in, you know, the whole draft thing. I was afraid to death, and the special ops group. So I've been focusing my research on the Vietnam experience because I feel many people know about the Tuskegee Airmen now because mm-hmm. they have been seen mm-hmm. at the Super Bowl, and there have been a lot of books. But a lot of people don't know, young people don't know about the whole Vietnam experience. They call it the Forgotten War. And it was the only war that we allegedly lost. Mm-hmm. So it's called The Devil's Bargain. That comes from a song that Joni Mitchell wrote about Woodstock, which was at that time. They were war protesters, and the Vietnam War was called The Devil's Bargain. It's a lyric from that song. Mm-hmm. So the plan is to talk about that entire era and then talk about the fact that there were more soldiers of color that served in the Vietnam War than there were white people. There were more black soldiers there than white. This is something that I found out in my research. I love research, so I've been at the Library of Congress. Mm-hmm. I have all of his records, all of his artifacts. Adrian has helped me to gather them. I have mom's stories. Mm-hmm. And so the dog tax chapter is one that I wrote last semester at Johns Hopkins, and mm-hmm. it's just a sample of what's to come. I'm working on it, and this has taken me years to mm-hmm. research. Mm-hmm. And now that I've absorbed all the research, now I'm ready to write.
Well, so we have only a few minutes left. This has gone really fast. I can't imagine that, you know, it's been an hour.
We can talk for days.
Yeah.
There are so many more stories that you can hear that, you know.
So I wanted to just really quickly talk about your Johns Hopkins University Writers Program. Give us like a 30-second, what is that? And then I want to move on to my last couple of questions.
Sure. Johns Hopkins University has what's called the Teaching of Writing Advanced Degree. It's online. I started in January. Mm-hmm. I'll be graduating in about 9 months. Mm-hmm. It's online if you take two courses. Mm-hmm. And part of the portfolio is writing short stories, poems, just about every genre of writing, mm-hmm. and then learning how to translate to the classroom. I've been a professor at George Washington University and also mm-hmm. Prince George's Community College. So it's not just writing, but it also gives you the pedagogy to go back and teach mm-hmm. others.
Uh-huh. And you've written a book called A Strong Right Arm. Yeah. So
and also a series called Willie Pearl After My Mother.
Really?
Uh-huh, and it had dolls of her and her best friend, May Ella.
Oh, my goodness.
The Strong Right Arm is about, quickly about a woman named Mamie Peanut Johnson, who was the only woman to pitch professionally. She pitched in the Negro Leagues for 3 years, and one of her teammates was Hank Aaron before he went up to the majors.
Wow. So we'll put the links to these books and where to buy them at the bottom of the podcast, and also we'll direct people to michelleygreen.com, and I'll put that link there too. Okay, we really have to wrap it up now, but I do want to, I mean, I could be here all day, but I wanted to ask Mrs. Young, and of course the two of you, you've lived through so much, you know, times that, you know, a lot of us have really only read in history books, you know, segregation, Jim Crow, the Civil Rights Movement, the anti-Vietnam movement. What do you guys think about what's happening right now in America?
Well, I can speak to that because all of my life has been in the military and then as a civilian. Yeah. I work for the Defense Intelligence Agency, so even as a civilian, I support the warfighter. So for me, it's difficult. It's a new world. It's not one that I'm enjoying, nobody else is enjoying, and social distancing, oh my gosh. Mm. It just seems like the whole world is, it's crazy. It's just crazy.
I applaud the Black Lives Matter movement because of the way it has consolidated the young people, the millennials, and it reminds me of the activism that we had back in the 70s. And, of course, there's a balance because some people have gone too far. But by and large, I support it. I will tell you that the Washington Redskins have finally given up their name as of today or yesterday. One of the names they're considering is Red Tails, which
I
we object to. We would prefer that they honor the Native American roots of that team instead of naming them after the Tuskegee Arrow, which has absolutely nothing to do with the Washington Redskins.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how that's going to go. They haven't listed a new name yet, but there's been a lot of talk out here in New Mexico about the Redskins name change. So what about Mrs. Young? What do you think about what's going on right now?
Well, to me, it seemed like it's just one big crazy mess. I had to get that in. That's what I think. And it seemed like a few years ago we had so much fun on doing things, but now we're at a standstill. We don't know what's up or what's down.
Well,
it makes it hard.
Yeah, well, this pandemic has knocked everybody for a loop for sure. So here's my last question. So, you know, the high school class of 2020, all these young kids graduating, ready to go and set foot out into this brave new world, and now there's pandemics and there's huge discussions about, you know, racism and social injustices.
Yeah.
What kind of advice do you give these young kids that literally have had their lives thrown upside down in the last few months?
Well, I have taught kids that age, and I would say it's unfortunate that they're being denied some of the basic rites of passage that we had.
Mm.
But I think it's a time for real introspection. I think they should be journaling. I think they should be thinking about their future in different ways, getting more acquainted with technology, making more family ties, being more aware of their own health and holding. I think it's a time for real learning and, you know, self knowledge, and developing positive attitudes.
Mm.
Trying to make a sense of all of this. I mean, they're the leaders of the next generation. And what decided I can say, to me, all lives matter.
Mm.
No matter what color, all lives matter.
So,
and I'm trying to keep this one here. This one, my mother doesn't understand. Yeah, she's 95, and I tell her, you know, when she, no, I'm not taking you to the commissary. No, I'm not taking you to these places. Her goal, and it's imposed by myself, I tell her, Ma, I want to see you on that jelly jar when I turn on the Today Show and you turn 100. So that's the goal for her. And today is their anniversary. It would have been, well, she says 67, but I think it's more than that.
Of your marriage?
And next month she will be 96.
Wow.
About a month from today.
Well, happy birthday in advance.
Thank you. And up until about 6 months ago, she was still driving.
Wow.
What do you mean still driving?
Yeah. Well, I mean,
she went out and washed both cars yesterday.
I know, I know.
I was going to say, you can drive, you just can't get out.
Oh, God.
Well, ladies, this has been absolutely wonderful. And I know our listeners are just, you know, in shock. They've been probably, you know, laughing and crying with the rest of us. So I wanted just to say we've spent a wonderful time, and thank you all for joining us today. And it was a wonderful conversation.
Thank you for whoever decided to do this. Thank you my sister, and this is something that we do to keep his memory going to us. It's not like he ever left, because the legacy goes all the way down to the 3-year-old.
Mm-mm.
Everybody says, you know, everybody called him dad, the friends, the family, the adoptees, everybody. He was simply dad.
So we never mentioned his name in this whole conversation. So
that's because he was dad.
His dad.
Name is Eddie, not Edward. Eddie, E-D-D-I-E, Lee, initial Lee, middle name Lee. Young, Eddie Lee Young.
Okay, very good. So,
I can't believe we never met.
No, I don't think
he's
we
always
did.
Dad.
Yeah. Well, and I think he was always your dad to me, so it's like, yeah. No, so this has been really good. I think we learned a lot about...
Well, Mom called him a number of other things, but we won't talk about it.
No. I've already been disillusioned about the Riveter, so yeah.
Yeah.
So listen, I wanted to thank our listeners and thank you guys for tuning in today. And our podcasts are funded in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities, the New Mexico Arts Council, the New Mexico Humanities Council, and several military brats organizations. And so we have to thank them for supporting us and telling these wonderful stories about military family life. So, thanks so much, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you.